Ghosts of Anti-Fascism Past. This is a second installment following the reintroduction of the operative inquiry that lies behind the arguments, themes, concepts, flights, and fancy, and polemics in the six essays I've posted thus far to my website, Ghosts of Anti-Fascism Past, posted at antifa.live.com. This second installment is going to focus on this three-wheeled contraption that I've been referring to, the three-wheeled stair climber. And, you can look at an image of it. You can see it. And the three wheels really, for any one to turn, the other two have to turn as well. For any movement to take place, right, the whole has to move. This distinguishes it from, well, any number of other contraptions of, you know, four wheels sort of moving, you know, separately. So in this sense, they're linked together, and their movement is directly linked to one another. This concept is related to two notions that are found in computer science and logic and language and elsewhere, those being the concept of iteration and reiteration, and the concept of recursion. So I'm fond of these, and my three-wheeled stair climber, which I'll remind you is composed of those three questions: what is fascism, what is anti-fascism, what is socialist strategy? So with iteration, with this concept, you're essentially carrying out a procedure that's used to try and solve a problem, and then repeating the procedure with some kind of deviation, some kind of change, in order to get closer to a solution, right? And so there's iteration, and reiteration is where you're, you know, trying again in order to get closer, okay? Recursion, however, is a different sort of concept. And in computer science, it's sort of tied to a different notion. And that is, you have a problem to be solved, for sure, and you have a procedure. However, the whole procedure has to be deployed, as it were. It has to be carried out in order for any individual part of it to function. So in other words, you have to apply the whole in order to carry out a part, okay? So these are two different notions that I'm very fond of both, and you can see them in language. Noam Chomsky has Noam Chomsky, the linguist, not the anarchist, employs this notion of recursion as it applies to the unbounded nature of languages. What he argues is its unbounded sort of nature. And that is that any sentence that you can construct, if you throw an "and," will just keep going, for infinity. You know, he picked up the ball, and then he threw it, and then it bounced on the roadway, and then someone else picked it up, and so on and so forth. So these two concepts of iteration and recursion also can't really be understood without a companion concept, which is that of the bit. And the bit is this term that figures prominently in one of my essays on Ghosts of Anti-Fascism Past, When Ghosts Dream of Angels, Part 2. And the bit is a portmanteau, a combination, if you will, of a binary and a digit. So it's a numeral and, you know, and black and white, one and, zero and one, on, off, yes, no, so on and so forth. And that concept is, I also wrote in one of those essays, it's sort of what you need to understand at the ground floor, the entry level of computing. But it's more than that. It's been described as one, if not the, what one of, if not the greatest insight of computer science. And a number of the greatest names in computer science are associated with it. Reading now, here's how this notion of the bit is rendered. So one of these insights is as follows. There are only two objects that a computer has to deal with in order to represent anything. All of the information about any computable problem can be represented using only 0 and 1, or any other bistable pair that can flip-flop between two easily distinguishable states, such as on-off, magnetized-demagnetized, high voltage, low voltage. In you know, logic, it's true or false, and in any number of other areas of human life, this notion of the bit and that the great insight of it is at the center of it. So iteration and recursion flow from this as methods, problem-solving methods. And what I'm basically arguing is that there's a relationship here, and that we can sort of explore this, and it might help in terms of answering these... it's necessary in order to roll my contraption forward. It's useful in looking at a social and political phenomenon such as fascism. So with iteration, using the bit as the foundation of this, let's discuss the differences between iteration and recursion, and then I'm going to go into an example. So with iteration, at this ground floor, it's the problem-solving method of iteration is best used for a series or for the application of the binary nature of the bit to really simple phenomena. So, for instance, traffic signals are one of the earliest applications of the logic of bit logic, okay, to you know, the world around us. And you can easily see how it's applied, eliminating the yellow light for purposes of argument. Red or green, right? Stop or go. And that you can see that this, how was it put here? Bistable pair flip-flops. And that in terms of electrical energy, that it was its earliest application at the, you know, at an intersection could be understood without understanding the whole, all of the traffic signals in a city. Okay? This is classic sort of iteration, that the logic of the traffic signal is totally independent of all of the other traffic signals everywhere else. This is also one of the geniuses of the, of the internet, that it, you know, was developed by DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects, whatever. As a way to, allow for the continuation of American political and military power in the event of some kind of catastrophe. So in other words, the internet in a node, and any particular node could reproduce itself irrespective of the whole. Okay? So in this sense, this is another application of it, that the traffic signal, you don't need to understand the whole thing around it. And if, so traffic signal is my first example of the iterative logic, and it's best understood in this way as straight as a series. And this is really, these are broad strokes, but kind of bear with me. The next example I'm going to use is that of a maze. Picture, if you will, Stanley Kubrick's treatment of Stephen King's book, The Shining, Kubrick's film, and the maze that features in that. It's hedges, right? These giant hedges. And the various characters have to navigate their way through the maze. Using iterative logic, and from the perspective of one of those characters, you enter in the maze, and there's really no way to figure out where the entrance is. Let's assume there's one exit. Let's assume there's one exit. You can't see where that exit is, and it's only by trial and error. It's only by, you know, one iteration where you come to a block, where you come to an impasse, then retracing your steps, trying another iteration, a reiteration, if you will, that you get through the maze. But if one had the perspective of the God perspective, if you were able to see the maze from above, you might also be able to detect patterns in the construction of the maze, which also could lead you to an exit quicker, more efficiently than the iterative method. So, in this sense, a recursive approach to solving the problem of the maze benefits from a different perspective. And what is that perspective? Well, it's the whole, right? So you can see the differences here. Third example would be a picture puzzle. Same logic here, right? If you go through and start fitting pieces together, you will, using iterative logic, be able to assemble the whole puzzle. But if it's piece by piece, it'll take you a long time. It is very comprehensive and very logical. But again, if you have the picture aside from the pieces that you're able to refer to, it makes for a different sort of logic applied to solving that picture puzzle, right? So if you're able to see the picture and work the pieces according to whatever image the puzzle is supposed to represent, that's a very different thing. So I've given you three examples of iterative and recursive logic. Now I'm going to get to the fourth, which is really the centerpiece of what I'm talking about here. The fourth example is the game of chess. And if traffic lights, a maze, and a picture puzzle are all solvable, they all have a mutually agreed upon outcome, an exit, a solution, the game of chess distinguishes itself, well, in many ways, but in one very important way for anti-fascist activists. And it's this. The game of chess is unsolvable. What do I mean by that? I mean that any game played in the last 1,000 years by anyone, anywhere, always, on the part of both players, had as a possible outcome win, lose, or draw. It's a very different sort of problem to be solved, isn't it? If it can't be solved, right? All you have then are better or worse efforts to apply principles that govern the game. So the questions that we're dealing with here, the problem we're trying to solve,
doesn't lend itself to the iterative logic that might help one solve a series, a maze, a picture puzzle. We're looking for something else. And the game of chess is a good example that might, well, I would argue it can help us. So my three-wheeled stair climber is this sort of operative metaphor. The climbing of the stairs is the tackling of the problems. It's progress. It's moving forward. Each wheel is one of these questions. And I use it to mean a recursive logic, a recursive approach to problem solving, because it's really a succession of interrogations, each of which depends upon the other in order to answer, in order to get to an answer. And each answer leads to another question or set of questions. So it's not really a goal that you're working towards. It's not an exit. It's more, I'm trying to capture this sense of something that has to fold back upon itself in order to unfold and move forward. All right. So this three-wheeled contraption of mine, the way that I see it functioning in relation to these three questions has a great deal to do with how I understand the game of chess. And there is no better way to understand the game of chess than through what I call the Sarawan method, which is it's a name that I made up, and it refers to the set of I think six books written by Yasser Sarawan, who was a one-time United States champion at chess and is an international grandmaster. Great chess player, right? And he wrote a series of books called Play Winning Chess in the 1980s and 90s. At one point, Microsoft Press published them. And Sarawan lays out basically four principles for understanding the game of chess. And rather than a system for playing the game of chess that relied upon sort of brute number crunching, you know, this sort of collection of all the great games that have been played, or, you know, bone crushing iterative logic where you memorize the lines, the precise algebraic equations involved in different openings and defenses, which really beginning and intermediate players are not capable of doing, not without a great deal of study. Instead of all of that, Sarawan lays out the principles. And the basic argument of the Sarawan method, and mind you, nothing of what I'm saying here, Yasser Sarawan would probably agree with or even know what the hell I'm talking about. It's not important. But the basic argument that I'm taking from that is that, look, you need, in order to get into the game, much less win a game, setting totally aside trying to be a great player, just getting into the game requires understanding those principles. And if you understand the principles, you can play a game as effective as anyone who's using brute iterative logic. Okay, that the two are related, the two can be used, but that understanding these principles is fundamental. So for our three questions, Sarawan's method and his four principles have two lessons that directly apply to, well, redefining what I call 21st century fascism, right? Reconfiguring, reworking anti-fascist politics today, and these four principles have something to say about the socialist project, about socialist strategy, you know, the socialist project and what kind of strategy one should use, could use, in order to achieve a fruition of the socialist project. So in other, so bluntly, I'm going to use the Sarawan method for analyzing, understanding the game of chess to reconfigure the question of what is fascism, and I'm also going to use one particular lesson from the Sarawan method to reinterrogate the socialist project. But first, I have to tell you about the Sarawan method. So the Sarawan method is based on the four principles. And the four. And by the way, if you're unfamiliar with the game of chess, or you're a beginner, or even an intermediate player, best to break out a chess set on your phone on a screen, or if you actually have a physical set, great. Set it up, take a look at the board. All right, because this will be quick and dirty, but interesting. So the four principles are, first, force, by which you can calculate a differential of force, an advantage or a disadvantage, by knowing the point values of each piece. So pawns are worth one, knights and bishops, they're knights, not horses, are worth three, rooks, not castles, castling is a move, not a piece. Rooks, those pieces on the end that look like towers, are worth five. Queens are worth nine. And, curiously, a point which I will come back to, kings have, an infinite numerical value. Why? Because, value can only be established when you lose it. Right? Value can only be calculated if you no longer have a piece, right? Or you have the piece from your opponent. But you can't lose a king, right? A king can't be taken. Therefore, its value is, either non-existent or infinity, right? Incalculable. Okay. So I will come back to that, but not right now. So at any point in a game, if you lose a knight to a player and capture a pawn, you would be said to have a two-point deficit to the other player. In high-level games of chess, 1 point at any point in a game, even in the early part of a game, can lead to defeat, and often will. So keeping an equilibrium or gaining any kind of point advantage is very important in the game of chess. Second principle is space, and you could calculate a differential of space, advantage or disadvantage, similar to force, by dividing the board horizontally in half, 64 squares on the total board. You have 32 on your side. Your opponent has 32 on theirs. Once you make a move, let's say the e-pawn to 4, you're attacking two spaces on your opponent's side. You would be said to have a two-space advantage. So the way you calculate space is by keeping track of and calculating how many spaces on your opponent's side of the board you attack and thereby control, okay? Occupy or attack, all right? So, and you want to keep very close track of that. Now, there's something else that's curious about space as a principle, and it's this, that any piece you put in the four central squares of the board are at their most powerful. In other words, any piece that you put in one of the four central squares in the middle will control more space than anywhere else you could put it on the board. Okay? Therefore, all play in chess, all opening play, the first few moves, will revolve around contesting those squares, fighting for control of those four squares. And this is another feature of space. You have to do that. And there are certain moves that help accomplish this and certain moves that don't. All right? Which is a nice way to transition into the third principle, which is development, which you can also think of as time, but not the time on the clock. It's, In any case, development refers to the speed with which you're able to accomplish these tasks, these things you need to do in the early part of the game. So, for instance, you need to fight for control of those four squares, but you also need to keep your king in safety. And then the safety of the king is paramount. It's not a principle. It's just, it's a premise even before a principle. And because your king in the early part of the game is in the center of your board, it is in is vulnerable to being attacked because the early theater of attack, the early, early conflicts, the main battle will be in the center. So, therefore, as a principle of development, one of the things you need to do early in a game is to get your king to safety. And there is no more efficient way to do that than castling, either kingside or queenside. And I've read somewhere that in all high-level games, like 90% of players castle kingside, or no, 90% castle, and like 80% of those that castle kingside, which is the quicker way. So in development, you need to make moves that help you contest those four squares and get your king to safety, and open up lines of attack and help you mobilize your pieces. Which is a good transition to the fourth principle, which is totally odd and out of left field, until it's explained. Very counterintuitive. And the fourth principle for Serwan is pawn structure. What you do with all the little guys, all the guys who are worth 1 point. And why that is a principle is because of the central role that pawns play in development and in controlling space, and how they must work together in chains. They have to be yoked together. They have to protect one another. And that pretty much all of the pitfalls and problems of pawn play in chess are linked to pawns that are isolated. In fact, an isolated pawn is one of them. Another is a passed pawn, one that's gone too far with no protection. Another is a poison pawn, that if you take it, something bad will happen. Backwards pawns, and so on and so forth. So those are the four principles, okay? A couple of sides on the game of chess. When I first looked at the game of chess when I was, I don't know, fucking 10 years old or whatever, the first thing that came to mind was, as soon as I understood the rules, was, well, why doesn't white win every time? I mean, white has the clear advantage. White gets to go first. And in checkers, it seems like, whoever goes first in checkers usually wins. Well, isn't this the case in chess? And there's something odd about the fact that a game of chess is unsolvable, all right? And it is this, that white doesn't always win. Well, how could that be? I mean, can't you reduce the game to an iterative sort of expression of the bit? Can't you reduce it to math or some one of the maths? And the answer is no. Why? Well, I have four suggestions as to why that's not true. And here they are. One is the king, which I will, again, come back to, and its indeterminate value. This fact throws the logic of the game totally for a loop. The fact that you have a piece that cannot be taken. Think about it. Look at the game. You'll see what I mean. But as if that weren't enough, you also have these odd sort of wrinkles in the game. One is castling, which is a move that involves two pieces, not one, and then is subject to a bunch of criteria. So, for instance, a king can't castle through check. It can't castle out of check. It can't castle if the king or the rook has been moved, so on and so forth. Can't castle out of check. Can't castle through check. It can't castle. Yeah, all right. So there's that. Castling is a bizarre move that mixes everything up. So does a pawn promotion, which in the game of chess, that means if you get your pawn to the first rank of your opponent, or your eighth rank, all the way to their other side, you can make that pawn into any piece you like. Usually it's a queen, right? So, and you can have two queens, yeah, if you can get your pawn over there. This, of course, makes everything totally whacked as well. Like, wait, what the fuck? Just as I was, you know, calculating what was going on, and just as I had a handle on everything, then I find out that at any point in the game, I can have not one but two queens. Oh, my God, right, okay. And then there is this really wonderful French term, en passant, which refers to an option given a player to make one of two moves as their move. Funny, isn't it? The term is French. It means in passing. And if you understand the game of chess and you want to know if your opponent, somebody at the local cafe or wherever that you're going to sit down and play with, if you want to know if they know the game of chess, you could always just ask them what's en passant. If they don't know what en passant is, then they don't know the game of chess. Okay, it's one of those obscure rules of chess, but one that it comes into play infrequently, but it does sometimes. So there's that. And en passant is, look it up. I'm not going to describe, but the move is really strange, out of nowhere. And there you go.
As another aside, I think it's important briefly to sort of dispense with the often glib and ahistorical critiques of chess that may come from, I don't know, a radical here and there, you know, that the game of chess, because it employs this notion of white and black and white moves first, it has racist origins. And, well, obviously it does, for sure. But it's important to understand that in 1,000 years, you know, whatever those concepts of white and black were then, they are certainly different than they are now. And more so, you can dispense with this critique by simply having black move first. You know, the board is a mirror image of itself on either side, and an exact mirror image. And if you feel more comfortable playing with black moving first, well, you can, and it is the same game. Secondly, you know, obviously it's rooted in feudal notions of power. You know, the king has indeterminate value, cannot be lost. The queen is super powerful, and then you have, you know, these viceroys and whatever, you know, knights and the bishops, and they all represent this, that, or the other thing. And I'm not, you know, dismissing social histories of the game. That's very, important. But in terms of the logic and in terms of the points I'm trying to make, don't get caught up in that. It's really not important. Yeah, you can make these points without having to concede that sort of nonsense. There is an odd sort of parallel with socialism that comes from, or radicalism more generally, that comes from a unique sort of power that pawns have. And it's not really often understood. And it is this, that one of the sources of power as a pawn lies precisely in its low value. What do I mean by that? Well, there's a move that a pawn can make that is particularly devastating, and it relates precisely to the fact that the pawn is only worth a point. And this move is something called the pawn fork. That's when a pawn that is protected attacks simultaneously two pieces of greater value, meaning that one of those pieces will be taken, have to be taken. There's no way out of that for the opponent, short of, you know, check or, you know, some move that, there are ways out of it. But in general, when a pawn forks two opposing players of higher value, you're really seeing the strength that comes from its low value. certainly a lesson that can be should be thought about in regards to socialist struggle.